May it please the court?
Yes, thank you.
It is our position that this reciprocal discipline case is before the court for the limited purpose of allowing Mr. Roswald the opportunity to persuade the court that mitigating factors exist to justify a lower disciplinary sanction than that imposed by the Kansas Supreme Court.
Now, he's been in practice since the 1990s, and he's had no other discipline in the state. We have no similar pro hypice rule, as does Kansas, and under the system of the ABA about graduated discipline, you're suggesting suspending him according to Kansas, being reciprocal to Kansas, when we don't have the same statute?
Well, we have a different pro hoc vice rule.
Right.
The rules of professional conduct that he has admitted violating are exactly or very similar to the Missouri rules. There's no difference in the substantive rules.
He didn't admit to any personal misconduct. He admitted that he personally failed to file these items on time or misled the court. Counsel, just a moment. He failed to, as required by the Kansas rules and in violation of the Kansas rules, to supervise his partner, Mr. Schmidt, who turned out, according to the allegations, according to what what has been found in Kansas, failed to protect his clients and failed to make certain filings and various other things for which discipline, I think, is pending. What did he do that would be a violation? Because there's no collateral stop. It's not just he's asking for mitigation. Our law is really clear. We give collateral estoppel to the facts.
Correct.
In a sister state. We don't give collateral estoppel to the discipline. We look at what discipline would be appropriate under Missouri law, aggravating or mitigating, whatever it may be. What conduct did he perform that would be a violation of Missouri rules? And in saying that, I was concerned at one point you said he admitted he knowingly violated certain rules, but my reading of it was that he knew that he had not, that the Kansas court found he should have knew or should have known, they would have inferred that he knew that his partner had not been admitted pro hoc vice, but I didn't see anything saying that he knew about the misconduct of his partner.
The two rules, well, first of all, let me delineate the actual rules of professional conduct that Mr. Roswald admitted violating in Kansas. An admission in Kansas should be an admission in Missouri. Those rules are 1.1, competence. He was the only Kansas licensed attorney. He agreed to represent a Kansas client in a medical malpractice case, and he then did nothing to adequately ensure that his non-licensed Kansas partner was appropriately and adequately representing his client.
He reviewed
the
pleadings,
didn't he?
That's the
first
rule. I
mean, he reviewed and signed pleadings, yes. Okay. Nothing further.
And in Missouri, would he have to have done anything further if one of his partners
I would think that a Missouri licensed attorney who agrees to represent a client and then tells an associate or another partner, you go handle this, when, say, the associate is not licensed in Missouri, there is some kind of competency requirement there to make sure that that person is doing an adequate job.
We have a separate rule. I think it's number 5.1 or 2 about, quote-unquote, subordinates and the responsibility of the...
True, but I'm talking about the direct responsibility that Mr. Roswald had to competently represent his client, not his...
Once he found out, would you submit he didn't do everything he could possibly try to do to rectify the situation?
He argued that to the Kansas Supreme Court. This is the difference. Mr. Roswald had gone through a diversion agreement in Kansas in 2006. The incidents in the underlying malpractice case were occurring in 2006, so we're talking about roughly the same time period, involving a matter wherein Roswald took on a workers' comp claimant client in a Kansas workers' comp case. Just as in our case, he turned the case over to Mr. Schmidt. Then some problems arose because It turned out that the client was videographed carrying on job duties many hours beyond what he had told the system he was able to do. And so he agreed with his lawyers that the case should be dismissed. No problem up to that point. The workers' comp carrier, however, talked to Mr. Schmidt and said, we're not satisfied with just dismissing the case. We want you to sign this agreed settlement, whatever that is in workers' comp law. Mr. Roswald was the only Kansas licensed attorney in the case. He agreed to sign that and did sign that agreed statement without conferring with his client and without providing the client with a copy of the agreed statement. Nor did Mr. Roswald discuss the matter with opposing counsel in
is
the
that,
case.
Is this a basis for discipline in this case?
I'm trying to get to the knowledge that Mr. Roswald had that this was a problematic way that he was practicing law with Mr. Schmidt.
Well, you're saying he should have known
prior,
not to trust Mr. Schmidt.
Well, and the prior diversion is much factored into the elevated discipline that you're asking.
In the Kansas discipline.
I mean, the fact
case.
That he has a prior diversion on his license involving the same person for basically the same allegations of neglect.
Correct.
So this easily could have, this is not a first offense, so to speak. It's not only a second offense, but it's a second offense involving the same neglect
very
to supervise, the same lawyer, under the same circumstances, under the same rules in Kansas.
Very similar factual underpinnings. And I'm also trying to get to the element
of knowledge.
But
they were about the same time, too.
The same time. This is why the Kansas Supreme Court rejected the Kansas panel's decision that all of this conduct was negligent. Because they said, we've looked at this diversion agreement. He was on notice that there were problems with the way that they were practicing law, and therefore we believe that he knowingly allowed a non-Kansas licensed attorney to go take depositions.
He admits he knowingly allowed his partner to do that, and you can believe or not, there was no finding that he knew in that particular case that he had not been admitted pro hoc vice. But they may have inferred that in their decision. Say this had not been that fact situation, and he had, as apparently did in all but two cases, in which were in Kansas, admitted his partner admitted pro hoc vice. Would any of this then have been a violation? Does it all depend on his failure? Did he still have an obligation to supervise in the way you're arguing? Would he still have that? If he had followed through with the pro hoc vice admission,
had moved to have Mr. Schmidt admitted pro hoc vice, I think almost all of the problems in this case go away. However, I want to go back, Judge Stith, to one thing you said. How do we know that he knew Mr. Schmidt was not admitted pro hoc vice? Wasn't that his job? He was the Kansas licensed attorney. Of course, he knew that he hadn't.
Well, there's things I should know I don't know, but I may be reckless in not knowing them, and certainly it could be one or the other. But there's a very big difference in failing to get someone admitted pro hoc vice and actually taking part in this misconduct by his partner. And you're saying we need to punish him as if he undertook that conduct himself, as I'm seeing it, whereas in Missouri, we do not have comparable rules requiring that you be to be personally involved and you requiring you to do the things that are required to do in Kansas.
That's because in Missouri, the visiting lawyer has to sign the initial pleading and make himself the attorney of record and get himself admitted before anything else is done, which is different than the way Kansas does it, but the protection of the public issue is the same underlying both states' pro hoc vice rules.
After the failure to get the pro hoc vice filed correctly, all the other misdeeds and ethical violations committed by Mr. Smith, according to the Kansas Supreme Court, they found that those were intentionally concealed from ARGA responded here. So I guess my question goes to, you know, how much responsibility do you have to be looking over and your partner's shoulder and digging through his desk to find out what's going on with his practice?
I think you have a heightened duty when you've already gone through a diversionary agreement wherein you have been put on notice by the disciplinary system that the way you're doing business, allowing your non-Kansas licensed partner to handle litigation is a real problem. One of the conditions of the diversion agreement in Kansas was that you review every pleading that comes into the office regarding your Kansas client and make the client aware of it. Now you can say, oh, but he intentionally hid the pleadings. So how could he have made his client aware? And the answer to that, Judge, is that because he was under a heightened awareness because of the diversion agreement, he should have had systems in place so that all pleadings regarding that his client were brought to him, or he should have been actively asking his partner, what's happening in that case? I haven't seen anything in months. Bring that client in. I want to talk to her. He did none of those things.
And are you suggesting that Missouri junior partners and associates have this obligation to the senior partners in their firm?
I absolutely am.
To demand to see the billing records, to demand to see what they've been filing and so forth?
I am.
Do you have new jobs for all those associates and junior partners?
I am, because our substantive rule on that reads exactly the same as Kansas's substantive rule on that.
And so when is it this obligation arises, you're saying, under our rule?
Under 4-5.1A2. The rules are exactly the same.
When does it arise? When would you have that obligation?
Well, according to the rule, when you know in time to do something about it. Mr. Roswald admitted in the Kansas case that he violated that rule, which reads exactly the same as Missouri's rule.
If Mr. Roswald had not taken on, I like to use the word responsibility instead of obligation, because that's really what he did. He didn't have to have the obligation. He could have sent the client and whatever fee went along with it somewhere else. But whenever he took on the responsibility a second time, after being on notice that his partner wasn't taking care of business, a responsibility he didn't have to take, you're suggesting that he should be responsible. In other words, this person would have been better off if he had not taken on the responsibility, because then he would have got a licensed Kansas lawyer who would have taken care of his case.
Or, as he did in this case, go forward, but with a heightened requirement that everything be cleared with him before actions were taken in the case.
Pro Hoc Vici means you're out of state. You can't be a resident and continue to get Pro Hoc Vici in the state of Missouri. I mean, you have to be, otherwise you should take the bar exam. I mean, you're not supposed to somehow get around the bar exam by saying, every case I do is going to be Pro Hoc Vici. So having
correct.
Someone who's arrested in Kansas is always going to be Pro Hoc Vici. But I think that's beyond the case. But thank
yeah.
you. So why did he, after the diversion, after he saw the problem with Mr. Schmidt, why did he do another case? Or was this case already in the hopper and they were all both kind of simultaneous, he had to deal with both these cases?
Thank you, Your Honor. To answer your question directly,
that's good.
The cases were basically concurrent. The diversion was handed down. And just to clarify the facts of the diversion a little bit, the particular thing that happened was there was this agreed dismissal document. Both Mr. Roswald and Mr. Schmidt reviewed it. They discussed it because it was unusual. They then decided that because it was, they believed, consistent with the direction of their client to voluntarily dismiss the case, Mr. Roswald did proceed to sign it. What they didn't realize was that although the opposing counsel had said this was simply a housekeeping matter, that opposing counsel had included language in there that not only said that you cannot pursue your case, but that in fact you were never entitled to benefits. The unexpected thing that happened here was that the opposing party then sought a repayment of monies paid. And in fact, I was looking for it, and I apologize, I couldn't locate it, but there was a reference, the opposing party was ultimately unsuccessful. And there was a reference somewhere that perhaps opposing counsel had played a little fast with what they were doing. Now, Mr. Roswald did discuss this with Mr. Schmidt. They discussed it at length, and Mr. Roswald came to the conclusion that this was an isolated incident. And one of the things that I think has crept into this case is this notion that Mr. Roswald did nothing except for sign pleadings. The record and is limited as it is, and one of the things we've asked is perhaps a chance to supplement the record. But the facts as they are, not the record, but the facts as they are, is that Mr. Roswald and Mr. Schmidt regularly discussed all of their cases, including, believe it or not, JC's case in which the wrongdoing was done. And unfortunately, as I believe was Judge Rhodes, Russell pointed out, that in fact, Mr. Schmidt lied to Mr. Roswell about the status of the case. And what's interesting is that the Supreme Court, the Kansas Supreme Court decision that's cited at length by the Office of Chief Disciplinary Counsel actually recounts that Mr. Schmidt was having phone conversations with the client, was telling her about the status of the case, and was in fact lying to her about the status of the case.
Now, did Mr. Roswell have an opportunity to put the facts into the record in Kansas? Because Judge Stitt said we're bound by the facts. Did he have the opportunity to put his facts in the record in the
There was a hearing that was scheduled in Kansas. Right before the hearing, he stipulated to certain facts. Now, the interesting point that Judge Stitt made was that while he stipulated these facts, he did not stipulate to the scienter, the mens rea. The Kansas Supreme Court, in looking at those facts, determined there was a finding of knowing violation. And an important thing, and both disciplinary counsel and I have both cited the ABA standards, if you don't have a knowing violation of the rules, you don't end up with a suspension here.
Going forward, does he have a relationship?
If he didn't want to stipulate to those facts, he could have put on any evidence he wanted to.
Absolutely.
Explain to me why we're not bound by that.
I think you are bound by the facts that were found, but the interesting thing is the facts were what occurred in the case. What Karen Cheney holds and what other courts hold is that this court alone has the power to exercise its independent judgment and decide what Missouri rules have been violated and what sanctions should be handed down.
I understand that, but you agree then we're bound by the finding that was made in Kansas about the knowing violation?
No, Your Honor. The determination that was a knowing violation by the Kansas Supreme Court's own opinion is deemed to be a legal conclusion.
That was not in your stipulation.
That is correct.
Okay.
Now,
it's your position. Just so I understand your position, is that each of us could review those stipulations and determine further ourselves whether or not that constitutes a knowing violation.
I think that would certainly be one thing that would be fair.
Were there any dissenters in the Kansas opinion?
I don't believe so. I know there were not. There was a per curiam opinion.
Now, does he still have a relationship with Mr. Schmidt?
He has a relationship only in that he continues to force Mr. Schmidt to provide him with information so that he can rectify all the problems. They are not partners. Mr. Schmidt was locked out of the firm shortly after he discovered the depth of the problems here. And other than that tenuous relationship, the answer is no.
Are there more complaints that have come forward after these two complaints?
There is a pending Missouri investigation that started at least in November of 2010. It was started actually based upon a self-reporting that Mr. Schmidt did at the demand and being forced by Mr. Roswell. To be honest, one of the things we find interesting is that there's never been any indication that Mr. Roswell will face discipline from that proceeding. And one of the things we argue at the beginning of our brief is this is primarily a Missouri lawyer. It was primarily a Missouri practice. Frankly, most of the problems are in Missouri. And interestingly enough, Missouri has had this investigation now for 2 years and has not, you know, seen any reason to go after Mr. Roswell.
I know hindsight's always...
And not that we're asking them to do that, but...
I know hindsight's always 20/20, and in this case, Mr. Roswell had tried to get better control of the finances or better knowledge of the finances of the firm and was rebuffed on that. Attorneys in similar situations, although he being subordinate to Mr. Schmidt, wouldn't the proper, more ethical thing to have done would be for Mr. Roswell to remove himself from the firm, to leave, and knowing the problems that Mr. Schmidt had and the potential for more problems that could expose him to ethical violations as well?
I think the short answer is potentially yes, but the tough thing, as you said, is it's 20/20 hindsight. Mr. Roswell knew that there was this diversion in Kansas, which frankly, they all thought they had been hoodwinked a little. And yes, there was a problem, and perhaps they should have caught it. And that's why he took a diversion. It was not as we all know, a diversion is a minor sanction. There was the second problem that he then learned about.
What's a diversion? Well, I don't think we had that in Missouri. What's a diversion?
You actually do have diversion. You'll never see them, though, because it's a type of discipline that effectively is less than an admonition. And what it does is they say to the lawyer, we found some violation, but we don't think it's very serious, so we're going to have you go to ethics school and perhaps receive some supervision.
When you say it's less, I don't necessarily agree that it's less than an admonition. It's certainly more private. It's certainly, and it occurs in situations where maybe the ethical violation is more serious, but it's an isolated incident where maybe somebody otherwise deserves another chance and an ability to keep things private, but I don't think it necessarily goes along with what the the allegation of the wrongdoing was. Lots of times they're given under circumstances maybe where people aren't harmed going forward, where the violation, where the person is caught before the damage is done, which didn't happen in these two cases.
Sure.
Can you address, in that work comp case, was there any suggestion in that case or any reason Mr. Rosenwald should have known that Mr. Schmidt was lying? Was there lying to him or to the client in that case?
There was not at all.
It involved negligence in reading the dismissal papers?
Failing to catch that there was an impact that this dismissal paper could have, yes.
So what knowledge would he have after that going forward, even in 2020 hindsight, what would have been appropriate for him to do?
And that's what we would say, was that it seemed limited. And frankly, as our brief discusses, after that, Mr. Rosenwald sensed that perhaps Mr. Schmidt was a little troubled. They had numerous conversations, but he didn't have any reason to believe there was something more. The interesting thing is, when the JC matter came up, if you look, and we filed in our appendix the letter that Mr. Schmidt filed with the Kansas Bar, I'm sorry, and that letter really said, oh, this is a case where I missed a deadline, I failed to file something. I talked to the client, and I basically said, I figured out what you would have been paid, and I'm willing to pay you that out of my own funds. Now, it turned out that was all a lie, but from the initial complaint in January of 2008 until Mr. Rosenwald got involved when he got the letter from Kansas Bar Council in November of 2008, that was the story that everyone thought was happening. And what's interesting here is that when Mr. Rosenwald received the Kansas Bar Council's letter saying, we have a complaint regarding this matter, he was the one that went and talked to Mr. Schmidt and said, tell me what really happened. And when Mr. Schmidt finally was forced to tell him what happened, Mr. Rosenwald immediately caused that initial report to be filed. And actually, I misspoke. I believe that was actually filed by Mr. Rosenwald.
Now, why doesn't Mr. You indicate it be a continuing relationship? Why isn't Mr. Rosenwald withdraw from all the cases with Mr. Schmidt and terminate any relationship whatsoever with him?
Well, he promptly did transfer over or it was in the process of transferring over, and I would say promptly, but immediately started transferring over the Kansas cases to himself. And as the brief indicates, ultimately did transfer all the cases. But again, I mean, in hindsight, we see this was a massive car wreck. But what Mr. Rosenwald saw at that moment was that his senior partner, his mentor of, 10 years, had made a limited mistake. And again, they didn't. In hindsight, the incident that led to the diversion should have been a warning signal. But at that
point,
it wasn't seen as one.
He knows he lied to him. He knows he deceived him. Why is he in any kind of arrangement whatsoever with Mr. Schmidt?
And certainly if you ask Mr. Rosenwald today what was your greatest mistake, that would be his greatest mistake.
What is
that he didn't run.
Is he now totally disassociated with Mr. Schmidt? Is he not on any cases with him? What's going on now?
Other than, there was a comment made earlier, and I appreciate Judge Price's choice of the word responsibility. Mr. Rosenwald continues.
Judge Price isn't here.
I'm sorry, Judge Fisher.
Fisher-Price.
I often wish I was Judge Price.
I understand. But as he stated, the term responsibility here, Mr. Rosenwald today, and I can tell you because I'm often involved, but Mr. Rosenwald today spends almost every day trying to fix the problems for Mr. Schmidt. And so, I mean, has he divorced himself? Absolutely yes, but he's still fixing all those problems, and that does require him to call his former partner and say, we've got this call from this client, we've looked at this file, tell us what's going on. But there is absolutely no legal partnership type relationship. In addition to the fact that Mr. Schmidt has no law license right now.
What has he done to help the clients who've been harmed by his partner's conduct? Has he provided them with reimbursement of some of their funds or paid damages, or what has he done?
Everything. They have talked to the clients, told them what happened. Some of the cases were transferred over. The ones that could be saved, and they signed new agreements. They found new counsel for people that would be better served by their counsel. There were a number of cases. Our brief identifies about 20. And by the way, in taking responsibility, realize that there's talk of 10, and we're coming here and saying, actually, there were 20. And in each of those cases, either a settlement has been worked out or they're still talking with people. And frankly, Mr. Rosenwald's expectation is that all those people will be made whole.
I want to take you back to something you said earlier about facts found by the court. You agree that any facts found by the Kansas Supreme Court were collateral estoppel. We have to agree to those two. True?
I believe I'm stuck in doing that by Carancini, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, the Kansas Supreme Court found that respondent knowingly disregarded his professional duties and was not merely negligent in these allegations. Now, I know that's not a part of the stipulated facts, but that is a fact found by the court. And you think you were couching it as a legal conclusion, but isn't that actually a finding by the court that there's collateral estoppel on?
Your Honor, the Kansas opinion is literally divided into findings and legal conclusions. The discussion of what should the mens rea be is actually in the legal conclusions. And what they do is the Kansas Supreme Court draws upon certain circumstantial evidence and then says, based upon that, we find a finding of knowing violation. So I would say it's a legal conclusion. And if I may, can I comment two things on this? The first is the circumstances they rely upon, if you look at them, only go to the question of whether or not Mr. Roswald knowingly allowed his partner to engage in the unauthorized practice of law, which, as we mentioned, is one issue. The problem, of course, is that there were a lot of other charges here, and the Kansas Supreme Court seems to then presume that the scienter is knowing for all of them. The second thing, and we argue this in the brief and cite to the Mirabile case, I believe under Missouri law that the circumstantial evidence there would not even rise to the level of supporting a knowing finding under Missouri law. And so as a legal conclusion, this court should not find
it. Well, if it was
violation.
In Missouri, we'd have Murphy versus Karen, and the facts before the, if it was a jury, maybe circumstantial evidence brought before the jury, but the jury decides the facts, whether there's mens rea or scienter. That's a factual determination. So whether it's mixed facts and law, whether it's knowing or not, is generally a factual decision, not a legal determination.
Your Honor, I mean, I can only say that I think, frankly, that however they got to the finding of knowing, it's manifest injustice. So I would say if that is, in fact, a factual finding, even under the ABA standards that are cited by the Chief Disciplinary Council, it is appropriate for you to undo that finding.
Well, here's the thing. Regardless of the findings, under the reciprocal disciplinary rules, there's very few limited circumstances where we're not to imply the same discipline, even if we would look at all this and find it differently, correct? I mean, you agree with that. One of them is that procedures are just so unfair that we shouldn't. Now, we're not talking about basketball referees here. You know, we're talking about the Kansas Supreme Court. You're not suggesting that the procedure they used was so unfair.
And no, not at all.
So as I understand your argument, you'd be hanging in on number three, which is that the imposition of the same discipline by the court would result in grave injustice.
Your Honor, I believe that is my strongest point to argue, yes.
Okay.
And I think to support that, the best example is the N. Ray Coleman case, where we look at someone who actually engaged in conduct including misuse of client funds, settling a case without the client's permission, and this court entered a stayed suspension. And as we've indicated
in
our
brief, case, there was no prior discipline, though, correct? Like there was the diversion here.
Well, interestingly enough, if we look only in Missouri, there was no prior discipline in Missouri. There was clearly the Kansas diversion.
As the author of that opinion, I may have a different memory of it than you do. I don't remember there was misuse of client funds. There was commingling, but I don't remember that there was misuse. Do you think the opinion?
I may have misspoken. I describe it in my brief, and actually have the description here. I can tell you. Okay. How I read it was,
I think he used one bank account for his funds and his client's funds.
His offenses included commingling client and personal funds in his IOLTA account, writing personal checks from his IOLTA account.
Right, but there was no indication that he didn't have his own funds in there to write the
Correct.
Checks. And that's a significant distinction.
Absolutely. And interestingly enough, there are other cases cited in the brief where, in fact, there was a misappropriation of client funds that ended up in substantially less discipline. And I do think that if we look at why people are suspended in Missouri, the conduct here does not rise. And I know I'm out of time, but if I may grace the court with one final comment. Judge Stith, you raised the question of how can we hold younger lawyers responsible, and realize one of the things that would happen here if Missouri says Mr. Roswald violated 1.1, 1.3, 1.4, 1.5, is in a circumstance like my own where I'm a partner at Armstrong Teasdale, if a senior partner is handling a case and has all the communications with the client, and I say to him, have you told the client this is happening? He says, yes. There's a suggestion here that I could be held personally responsible if that communication did not occur. Now, I don't think that's what we want the law in Missouri to be, and as you indicated, I think it would be impossible to have that be the law. I think there may be a 5.1 violation, but there should not be a 1.4.
But really, isn't the issue really different here? The issue is whether or not we should impose reciprocal discipline. I mean, that's the issue. This is not all new here.
No.
If this was all new here, you might have a better case, but the issue for us is, do we honor reciprocal discipline? Would we want Kansas to honor our reciprocal discipline?
And I, yes, you are correct, and I ask the court to look at the Whitehead decision cited by Chief Disciplinary Counsel, where Maryland went through the exact same process and said, we obviously have an obligation to respect what Kansas decided in Kansas. We can't say you can go practice in Kansas. But in that case in Maryland, and they cite to a Florida case, and I and Karen Cheney supports here, what happens in Missouri, the Missouri Supreme Court decides.
Well, and in fact, the law is we don't discipline someone here for violation of Kansas rules. We look at what conduct was found in another state and determine whether it would violate Missouri rules, and then determine what discipline Missouri would impose for that violation had it occurred in Missouri, but we don't retry the fact.
Exactly. And I believe that if you do that, in fact, what you will find and what we're asking for is that Mr. Roswell should receive a lesser penalty than was imposed by Kansas. Thank you.
And following up on Judge Stinson's case, I mean, we've seen countless cases where we have a superb Office of Chief Disciplinary Counsel, very humanistic, very compassionate, very helpful to the lawyers, to the people complaining. When I started practice, if I violated a trust account thing, I would assume I'd be disbarred. But we have all these helpful ethics courses. If someone said, I did this and that and I'm sorry, well, we could bend over backwards to try to first make the complainants whole, but to try to help this person through whatever problems they have. I mean, Mr. Roswell had no prior discipline except for the other companion case in Kansas, and had been practicing in Missouri for 20 years. And if it was happening in Missouri, as Judge just said, the facts we accept, but as far as what discipline to mete out, there's countless cases in Missouri where people have made mistakes. We've stayed suspension, or we've put on probation, or we're very humanistic, which is a wonderful aspect of our disciplinary council.
I totally agree with you, Judge Teitelman. There's one thing I have to emphasize to the court that I think has been lost here somewhere. We've talked about facts and what weight Karen Keeney and collateral estoppel has in acknowledging that those are the set facts. What's missing here is that Mr. Roswell admitted that he violated each of the charged rules in Kansas. He has admitted that he violated the rules, not just the facts, but that he violated the substantive rules.
He knew about any of the misconduct, though, and you agree. He admitted he didn't get his client admitted, his partner admitted pro hoc vice, and that violated the pro hoc vice rule, so he was responsible under Kansas law for those violations. Or are you saying he admitted he knew about that and he purposely didn't answer them, and you're saying we should assume that he actually did all this misconduct himself?
He admitted he violated the competence rule. He admitted he violated the communications rule, the diligence rule. Every one of the rules, not only at the hearing, but before the Kansas Supreme Court.
But none of those three, when people violate those in Missouri, they generally don't result in, unless there's multiple claims of that, or multiple situations over years, they don't result in disbarment.
But we're talking multiple violations here, as in the Cruz
case. Did he admit his conduct would have violated those rules in Missouri?
They're exactly the same. The rules read exactly the same.
What strikes me is we often hear you come into court and you argue that we should be harsh towards someone because they don't admit that they have done something.
Mm-hmm.
And that they're disagreeing that their conduct was not a violation of the rules. What I'm reading into his admission is that he is taking full responsibility for his violations. And I understand what Judge Fisher's saying, we have the issue of reciprocal discipline, but I don't get the impression from reading the facts. I believe we have someone remorseful, we have someone taking full responsibility, we have someone who's misconduct was the lack of supervision. He was in the circumstance of it being a senior partner. All of those normally would warrant us to to reach the conclusion that this person is not someone who's likely to discipline again, who we need to impose to have discipline again, that we need to impose supervision or a harsh punishment. Am I misreading the circumstances there?
I would say that you're overemphasizing the mitigating factor of cooperating with the disciplinary process, which is a mitigating factor, which is, you're very right, often not present in a disciplinary case. It
and
is present
that
in this
case. You're saying
it
wasn't in this case, or it was?
It was. He admitted everything. I'm just saying that the substantive violations of the multiple rules of professional conduct, which he has admitted violating, are so serious, and that they involve the element of scienter in at least two of them. The one on knowing that your partner's doing something wrong and not intervening at a time when you can stop it includes the word knowingly in the rule itself. Mm-hmm. By admitting that rule, he has admitted the element of scienter. I'm saying that all of that misconduct is more serious that suspension is appropriate.
And that is what the Kansas Supreme Court found he knew, is that he knew that Schmidt was meeting and advising JC and had not been admitted pro hoc vice, knowingly assisted him in the unauthorized practice of law by signing notices for depositions, and knew about the work comp case. It didn't find he knew about any of the underlying misconduct, but it found he knew, although his client had not been admitted pro hoc vice and yet was practicing in Kansas. That's what he knew.
Correct.
Okay.
The court, thank you very much. Case will be taken under submission.